Welcome back, podcast listeners. This is Andrew.
And Joe.
And today, we're going to give you a rebroadcast. This is a broadcast of an episode that we had previously uploaded, but we're doing it again, because over the next couple of weeks, we are going to be breaking down evidence that is against the speculum. And I think this is the part one of maybe a two or three part series where we're going to be talking about how often is a speculum really needed.
Warm up the speculum and get ready, because this is going to be a good one.
Completely agree. So this is, like I said, a rebroadcast. If you are a man and you have a wife or daughters, this podcast applies to you. If you're a woman, well, naturally, this one also applies to you. So these next two or three podcasts will be for everyone. Knowledge is power. I think we can give them the episode.
Absolutely.
Here we go. Welcome back to Questioning Medicine. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida.
And I'm Joe Weatherly, and I'm soaking up those beautiful rays and enjoying that mild temperature during our hurricane season.
Nice. All right, so that song was Na Na Hey Hey Hey, because today we are saying goodbye to the bimanual exam, the pelvic exam. Just recently came out, American College of Physicians, pretty much saying no more pelvic exams, no more bimanual exams. We're going to discuss it during this podcast. It's been a topic of debate this whole week. Surprise, surprise, ACOG has said, are you kidding me? This is crazy and ludicrous. But we're going to look at some of the evidence and maybe find out, is it crazy or has this just been something that's been a long time coming and maybe we should have been not doing pelvic exams for some time now. So we'll just kind of hop right into it here. And just to make it clear before we start this is the pelvic exam and the bimanual exam, not the PAP. So when you're screening for cervical cancer, I don't think there's any doubt that helps. The numbers on it, we can discuss another time, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're just talking about the pelvic exam, the bimanual exam, different situations in which they're used, and they probably shouldn't be used. So first of all, we can just say, or at least I can say, I don't know any woman that likes the pelvic exam. I've yet to meet one.
Never.
Have you?
Maybe that's just because it was you giving them. You know, the cold hands, that whole thing, you got to have a little bit better bedside manner than that. Warm up the hands, take the speculum out of the freezer a little bit earlier. They won't complain so much.
Maybe that's what it is, but I don't know any that agree with it.
Can you blame them?
No.
I mean, who?
Are you kidding? No way.
I mean, we call, as a little kid, we learned the phrase private parts. You know, I mean, nobody really, well, most people really don't want those parts exposed, and most people really don't want instrumentation placed in them for sure. I mean, I don't know. In men, no men randomly elect for catheterization or a DRE. It's just not comfortable, right. And it's not enjoyable. But if you told me I had to have it, well, maybe.
Right.
So there's a interesting. I mean, I'm married, so discussing with my wife, you know, what she thinks of her OB, and at this point, she's like, well, you know, it's just what they do. And I was like, what if I told you you never needed to have them put their hand in you or their fingers in you or push down on your belly and do all that? She was like, well, you got kidding me? Of course they have to. That's how they find cancers and stuff. And I was like, okay, well. So there's that component to it. But we were discussing some of the other aspects of this new publication and some of the changes that it might make. There's a discussion on an article that was printed just a little bit ago. One of the major focuses on this 2002 article 12 years ago in Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine was the emphasis on how teenagers and those people that, you know, are a little early in the screening process, but if we're checking for gonorrhea and chlamydia, which is part of this discussion, how they preferred to be tested. And they gave them the choice of first urine void, they gave him the option to have a doctor come in and do a pelvic exam and swab, or a clinician collected endocervical swab, or they could do a self-collected vaginal specimen. And guess what, Andrew?
They didn't want the doctor?
Yeah, can you believe it? With a gigantic majority preferring to do it themselves, or themselves collect their own urine, but almost nobody wanted the doctor to do it.
I was going to say, did anyone actually pick the doctor?
Yeah, there were some. I mean, there's some, you know, and then you can understand that. If they say, oh, this is a medical technique, there's got to be years of training in how to swab, and what if I don't do it right, and what if I don't know. There's some insecurity in some people. So they had the normal placebo-level people that didn't
that
want...
believe that this is part of...
Doctor magic.
Right. Doctor magic. Exactly.
One of the interesting things in this survey of the women that they were polled and had this principle discussed is that they actually had a question in their survey that said that they asked women if they felt like they were taking care of their health, and more women reported that they felt like they were taking care of their health by doing their own than if they had the doctor do it. So kind of empowering the patient, which I think is yet another subtle background now in medicine that we've been trying to do with this shared decision making and all these great movements in medicine. I think this is maybe one small step in that same direction.
Exactly. And kind of what you were just saying there of maybe, and those few that pick the physician to do the exam, is they just believe that this is what has to be done. This is it. This is what we do. And I think some physicians think that, well, I understand what you're saying. Maybe we won't do it for screening, or maybe we wouldn't do it in... I can see why they wouldn't want to, or they'd be embarrassed, but I have to do it if I'm going to prescribe birth control. If I'm going to prescribe birth control, I need to do a pelvic exam. And not so much. I'm choosing wisely. Choosing wisely campaign. If you don't follow that, you should. And no matter the field, no matter who comes out and says these are choosing wisely recommendations, and no matter the field that you practice in, you should probably reconsider anything you're doing if it's one of the recommendations to not do or do a certain thing. And American Family Physician, one of their choosing wisely bullet points is don't require a pelvic exam or other physical exam to prescribe oral contraceptive medications. So that's pretty clear cut, pretty straight to the point. You know, don't do it.
And it makes sense, right? Because especially in the light that maybe we're not getting as much, which I know we're going to go into a little bit, but there are a lot of, I guess the best way to say it is, if we're preventing a woman from getting on birth control, she's probably trying to not have a baby. And if we prevent that, now we've got more problems than just chlamydia, than just, you know, low-grade dysplasia of the cervix. We've got all kinds of new problems that we're creating if we have, socially, if we have people that are wanting to get protected sex or wanting to get birth control for prevention of pregnancy, and we're denying it for any reason.
Right.
Especially a reason that doesn't directly contribute to their health.
Right. There's... Why would we... Yeah, exactly. No denying that. And in Obstetrics Gynecology 2010, they actually just sent out a survey. They sent out a survey to just under 1,200 participants and just said, you know, do you require a pelvic exam for oral contraception? 30% of OB-GYNs said absolutely. 30% of family medicine physicians said absolutely. And they also included nurse practitioners in here, and 45% of nurse practitioners said absolutely. So we're looking at roughly a third of the physicians and almost half of the nurse practitioners are requiring pelvic exams for oral contraception. And if you haven't looked into, or I don't know what the yield you think you're getting out of this test by doing or trying to then maybe deny the birth control, but that for sure needs to have a big red X through it.
Yeah, and I mean, that again, this part of this is the catch-up. You know, we in medicine, we pride ourselves in being read, well-read, and trying to intellectually integrate some of these new things that are coming out. But to be honest, there's also the concept of not being the early adopter, where they talk about you don't want to be the first guy to jump on any bandwagon, because too often these new fandangled
Vioxx
drugs are right. Actually not that beneficial. But then we also don't want to be the last one to jump off or jump on. Because everybody else is doing it, and it's amazing, it's saving lives. Why aren't you doing it? Well, you shouldn't be that either. And I think most of us, probably in family medicine, tends to be more conservative than other fields. And I think that's part of the reason why we're still demanding that percentage of doctors demanding a physical pelvic exam, or a visit, actually, to prescribe a medication that they've been on for years. That doesn't really make sense, but I think that's why we've been doing it. We're late adopters too often.
Which is too bad. So, all right, we've put an X on that one. I think we all can agree that women don't like it, and they would rather not have it if they had their choice, or at least most women. So, chlamydia and gonorrhea, or BV, you can take your pick. Obviously, this is one where we must do a pelvic, right? I mean, they have chlamydia, they have gonorrhea, they have BV, they come in saying, I had sex with, you know, I was going to say Joe, but your name's Joe, so we won't use that.
We'll just say they had 15 different episodes of high-risk sex.
All right, there we go.
So they probably have something.
So right, and
you're going to dive in, swab them, and find out which one.
I think that for most physicians would be a slam dunk. This is a time when I absolutely need to get the pelvic exam. And to be honest, for me, this one was pretty shocking. I would have probably said, yeah, that is a time when you get a pelvic exam. But we don't. In fact, we physicians are actually worse at detecting it when we do it, when we do the swab, than if the patient just does it themselves. Which is depressing, but good news at the same time, because we're finding a better way, and the better way happens to be the way that the patient usually prefers anyways.
And that blows my mind, Andrew. Like, what we see in medicine is this patient empowerment. We've got to the point where birth control could be regulated probably by pharmacists in a lot of patients. We've gotten to the point where, you know, over-the-counter PPIs and H2 blockers, over-the-counter interventions that we used to have, you know, all control over. And I think at some point it's probably reasonable to have, right next to the pregnancy test, have a test for GC, chlamydia, BV. I mean, I don't really see the harm in them testing, but at the same time, then at least they can say, "Oh yeah, yep, I've got it again," and we can stop the spread of these common, because there is some morbidity associated with them. There's a lot of embarrassment and inconvenience too,
right?
But we could probably diagnose a lot more,
right?
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, pelvic inflammatory. I mean, I don't know what the absolute numbers on that are, but we could absolutely decrease it, for sure, if it was easier and more accessible. And you're right, you could just go buy it like it's a pregnancy test. You could just do it. And the results of this were probably best shown in BMJ 2012, where they looked at just about 4,000 women, let the women either vulvo-vaginal swab or do an endocervical swabs, and we found out that when the women were doing it, so the vulvo-vaginal swabs, there was a 97% sensitivity. When the physicians were doing it, 88% sensitivity. And if you relay that into some numbers that are more easily understood, roughly, physicians, we were missing one in every 11 cases of chlamydia when we were doing it.
Now, no, when they were doing it. Not me, because when I do it,
right,
I get 100%.
Well, yeah, yeah.
So you mean
you,
they.
You're perfect. You
they,
because right.
I, you know, they probably weren't trained as well as I was.
Shut
but
up.
They. You know, as doctors, it's always them.
When it's always somebody else.
Every surgeon I've ever met never has complications. His patients never come back to him because they don't have any complications.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. So, I think it's just another point that we think that, and this is what was shocking to me, is that we think, oh yeah, this is where you need a physician. This is where a physician needs to, you know, can come in handy. Not really. The patient can do it better than we can. And while they'll need our help to write the medication, or to get the medication, maybe even in the future, if you come in with a positive test, you won't even need a physician, because I think, you know, society as a whole, we could agree that if someone's doing one right there in the pharmacy and it's readily accessible and they paid for it, they could probably just go to the pharmacy and get the, you know, the treatment right then and there.
Or to a small community group, you know, like sure. all these Planned Parenthood,
sure.
all these other outreach programs that try to promote women's health. And what's sad is, going back to late adopters, 2009, so 3 years before the article you're talking about, Academic Emergency Medicine did a study on women in the ED about whether or not they could do self-administered GC swabs, since they see a ton of them, and they were great. I mean, in 2009, we're talking, it's been 5 years, we should already be doing this. We should have already had at least two or three more small trials and said, wow, they're as good as us, there's minimal harm, we're empowering the patient, and pretty soon it will be over the counter and we'll have given them years of training with their physician if they have a question right there in the clinic. Okay, here's this Q-tip, I want you to do this with it. Then you walk out and you come back and they, you know, it's the wrong color or the Q-tip's missing and you say, where's the Q-tip? But you walk through everything with them and we're training them on how to take good care of themselves and we're empowering them. It's one of those tools of the trade for life now for these high-risk people. They're going to need to be able to do this.
Completely agree. And that study I was just talking about in BMJ, the specificity on women doing the exams on themselves was 100% specificity. It doesn't get better than that.
No.
So, once again, this, I think we can all agree on multiple things. We can all agree that women would prefer to do it themselves if they could, or just not have it done. I think that we can agree that you don't need it for birth control or to prescribe birth control. There is enough evidence out there that they are as good, if not better, than us when we're looking for chlamydia, gonorrhea, BV. We don't need that. So what about just doing a yearly pelvic exam screening for ovarian cancer when we're looking? I mean, ovarian cancer is fifth leading cause of death in women. So maybe this would be the time when we should do pelvic exams.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, we've got to treat the fifth leading cause of death in women. You've got to. You've got to find that early. You've got to treat it aggressively and make a difference.
Yeah.
Whatever makes a difference, you've got to do that.
You would think. So this is pretty much where the American College of Physicians, their main study, I guess, looking, or a lot of, I guess, where it's, what it's based on, these recommendations, is the PLCO, the effect of screening on ovarian cancer mortality. And I'll post a link to this on questioningmedicine.com. We finally got the website up and running, so if you want to go just read the study yourself and see what you think, don't take our word for it. But an incredibly well-done study where is a random control trial, initially screened just over 78,000 women. That's a lot. 78,000 women. I mean, you're getting, that's impressive. Ages 55 to 74. Once again, that's important because this is the age that we would typically start being concerned of ovarian cancer, or that women would develop ovarian cancer. And they're split in half. Half of them were to receive just usual medical care. So they're going to their doctor, usual medical care, probably pelvic exams, bimanual exams, you name it, just the usual care, the usual thing you get. The other half were getting transvaginal ultrasounds, annual CA-125, so the blood marker looking for ovarian cancer, and originally they were also supposed to get bimanual screenings. But a couple years into the study, they stopped the bimanual part of the screening because by itself, bimanual picked up zero ovarian cancer. So
wow.
They said, we're throwing that part of it out. They followed these people for 12 years, just over 12 years. And in the screening group, so the ones that were getting, you know, the transvaginal ultrasound, the CA-125, the bimanual for the first couple years, but then they stopped it because it was showing no benefit. With the follow-up, there was 212 cancers diagnosed. And in the usual care, so just people not getting this fancy high-tech stuff, there was 126 diagnosed. So you picked up an extra 36 over 12 years with 34,000 patients.
Wow.
If you just think about that, those numbers for 12 years, right about 30, we'll just say 35,000 for easy numbers. 35,000 patients, 12 years, you picked up an extra 36 patients compared to just usual medical care.
You picked them up, so you detected it.
Right.
Now, I guess taking that to the next level, the one article that I found that really kind of hit home to me was a 2010 gynecologic oncology article that said, even when we find it in either high risk or low risk by screening with serum markers, sonogram, or pelvics, we are unable to affect mortality.
And that's exactly what this showed as well. There was no stage shift. I mean, we didn't find them any earlier. There was increased survival, slightly, but not statistically significant. So we found them 2 months earlier rather than 2 months later. That's an exaggeration, but we found them a little bit earlier. But their mortality, the age at which they died, it was no difference.
I think that shows that we don't have a good diagnostic approach.
We don't.
We need to find something new. Whether it's a novel serum biomarker, whether it's better screening, maybe enhanced ultrasound technique, something. Something's got to be found, because this is a terrible cause of death. It scares people. Women, you know, I know that there's a lot of inherited conditions through Lynch syndrome, where they're at a significantly increased risk of ovarian cancer. And we've got to help these people out by finding something new that we can actually do that makes a difference. And apparently it's not what we do right now.
Absolutely. And that, I think what a lot of OBGYNs are saying is, well, you know, it's the fifth leading cause of death. We have to do these pelvic exams. We have to screen for this. But the problem is, there's zero studies that we were able to find that show doing pelvic exams or doing bimanual exams actually decrease mortality or improve mortality compared to not doing them at all, or any fancy technology. We just don't have anything good for it. So I understand what they're saying, that we want to catch these early, and I agree, we do, but we're not catching them earlier is the problem. So we're not catching anything earlier, we shouldn't be doing them, because it's not necessary.
And there's a small sidelight. And again, I mean, these discussions we have aren't meant to say you absolutely cannot or should. We're not guidelines, obviously, and even guidelines aren't the things you should and shouldn't do all the time. We're just wanting to create the discussion or create the concept in your head that maybe it's time to question this practice, since it should have been questioned 10 years ago or longer ago. And we've got other things that come into play, like we discussed with the women that don't want to be swabbed by a doctor. Well, one of the problems, I mean, and this is a logical discussion, I'm not saying this is based on evidence, but there are women that avoid doctors for trying to avoid the pelvic. I've got a patient that came in the clinic last year, hadn't been to a doctor in 5 years, no labs drawn. She had been previously diagnosed with diabetes and was untreated because she was so afraid. The last visit she had, her doctor said, the next time you come in, you must have a pap, pelvic, and breast exam. You've gone too long, or else I won't give you your metformin. The patient said, okay, doctor, and the patient never went back. So this lady's been untreated. Her hemoglobin A1C was 11. And I'm not saying that this is the end of one. Again, I'm not saying this is we should make a guideline or break guidelines because of this, but it's the concept. And I'm sure we've all seen a few, at least, that are like this, where they avoid care for all the rest of their medical problems because of fear of a procedure or a technique or surgery.
Yeah, I mean, it's like men and prostate exams. Same, they'll avoid a doctor. You probably shouldn't be doing a prostate exam, and if you are, you should reconsider that. But the men will. My cousin actually avoided going to the doctor for a while for that same exact for prostate. He did. I'll get a prostate exam. I don't want to go.
That's
so
true.
We shouldn't be doing it. When we develop these podcasts, we always usually have a question in mind. And today's question is, you know, what is ACOG waiting for? Why are they waiting so long to not support these recommendations by the American College of Physicians and jump on board with their own recommendations or guidelines saying, yeah, they're right, this is the, we're not very good. And I think Upton Sinclair said it best when he said, it's difficult for a man to understand something when a salary depends on his not understanding it. Their livelihood, their kids' braces, their boat, their vacations are based on the fact that you have to come in every year for a pelvic exam. And you take away that, you really need to go to the doctor once every 3 to 5 years, depending on what they're using, hopefully 5 years, for a pap. That's a drastic decrease in what their current numbers are. I can see why they're not supporting it, but once again, if you're doing this for the patient, there shouldn't be a question. It should be what's best for them, and pelvic exams, really in any situation, it's not what's best for the patient.
Exactly. So I think one of the big hesitations, one of the reasons, Andrew, that this hasn't already, maybe why even the most progressive doctors haven't adopted this already, is because of a great concept where we don't really become early adopters because we have an internal belief system, and those are hard to change. Cliff Reed, who's an emergency medicine physician, I believe he's practicing in Europe, but doesn't really matter because his knowledge is part of foam. So he's right here in the room with us every day. But he gave a great talk on making things happen. And I know that Scott Weingart, I don't know, he's not part of my specialty, but he's part of medicine. And he gave a great discussion on change, too. And they both talked about how we have to actually change the way we personally believe. Not the way what the evidence says, because the evidence has been saying that pelvic exams haven't been good for 5 or more years.
At least 5 years.
But we've believed that they were good. We've always believed those studies are crap. That N's too small. That's not statistically significant data. Or we always made an excuse why it didn't apply to us. Because those pelvics are being done by probably PGY1, you know, IM docs that don't really care. And, you know, that's why. We've always discounted, and I think it's probably time to see if we can adjust our belief system, as Cliff Reed would say, in order to really adequately and accurately interpret the new studies. And by new, I mean less than 10 years old. So going back to one of Andrew's history lessons, as Andrew likes to do, we're going to go back to 1957 for the closing thought. American Cancer Society, for the first time in medical history, recommended a test called a pap smear. They recommended it be routinely done. We know the history since then. ACOG immediately jumped on board in 1975, and they decided that that's a good idea. They also then recommended...
Hold on. 54 and 75?
57 to 75.
So almost 20 years later, they jumped on board?
Yep.
Okay.
They rapidly jumped on the chance to intervene in what we now know to be one of the greatest changes in women's health, the pap smear. Almost 20 years late. I mean, American Cancer Society was up to date in 1957. So then in 1980, American Cancer Society said, we should probably make this annual pap. Started around 20 because we're still losing too many women or having morbidity in too many women for this stupid cancer that we should be able to find and treat. And that pap smear is gold. It's doing a great job. And, of course, ACOG only a few years later adopted their beliefs also. So I think that's why, Andrew, ACOG hasn't already jumped on. They're waiting. It's going to be 20 years. We're looking for the 18-year window where they slowly peruse the evidence. They continue to fill their schedule with annuals and quarterlies, and people that just don't even need an annual or a quarterly but want birth control refills. Just something, because that keeps the office visits coming in, and you never know what you're going to find that you could possibly do surgery on.
That's right. And so that brings up a great point. Slow adopters.
Yep.
Really slow adopters.
And I think it's hard. And when you look back at some of the evidence that says why we're doing this, American Journal of OBGYN in February of 2013 discussed why. It was a survey of OBGYNs currently practicing in America. And they said, why do you do? They gave them a vignette and said, would you do a pelvic on this woman? A pelvic. And they said, yes. And then they said, okay, why? And the reasons they gave, 45% of all OBGYNs cited standard of practice. as the reason, one of the reasons why. Patient reassurance in 49% of OBGYNs is why they do a pelvic, to give the patient reassurance. And then 47 of them felt like that was the best thing to detect ovarian cancer. 59% of OBGYNs agreed to do a pelvic examination for benign condition identification.
Benign.
I mean, all this goes back to that's their belief system. It's not based on evidence. It's not based on anything other than I really think this is good, which just goes back to the standard practice, patient reassurance. They think the patients want it. But I bet if they gave them the option, hey, I could do this pelvic exam on you or not, and we're probably going to be about the same place, I bet 100% of those patients are going to say, well, I'll pass then. I mean, you've got, you know, if you've got some evidence, or if you really even just believe that it will help, I'll do it. And that's when they'll be, oh, I believe it'll help. And then they do it.
Right.
Way too often. 68% of OBGYNs do pelvic exams in asymptomatic women solely for the reason of cancer screening, of ovarian cancer. 68%.
Which we know doesn't. That they do it.
It's not a great detector. We're giving them a false sense of reassurance that, hey, you know what? I just swept the ovary up against my finger. It's normal size, normal shaped. No chance of cancer, ma'am. You're fine. When in reality, that was probably a lipoma.
It's not a...
Right. I mean, you're moving on. I don't know what it was.
It's not a great... Not, I wouldn't say it's not a great... It's an awful test. It's not. We have nothing good for this cancer. Maybe that's where research needs to be heading, is something better for this cancer. But it's not where it's at right now. Absolutely not. I think we've hit it on all points. Really, there's no reason, unless your patient really wants it. And then once again, it is patient-centered care and hopefully patient-centered decision-making, but the pelvic exam can be put to rest. Nana, hey, goodbye. What do you think?
That's terrible. That's what I think. I thought you were a singer. I thought you were a singer, but
no.
Maybe you should stick to medicine, because that's what you're good at. But yeah, I think that's pretty clear. I mean, another thing we should probably do, this isn't just a podcast about any one thing. I mean, we're hoping to make a change. We're hoping somebody will hear this, be motivated to go find out for themselves because they thought we were crazy or whatever, or maybe they thought we were right, but go find out for themselves. And then, like some of these great teachers like Cliff Reed, go look at yourself and see how far off of early adopter or how close to late adopter you are, and consider why you're that person.
Exactly. So we got some things coming up in the future here. If you have the app, if you have iPad or Apple product and you have the app QXMD Read, we are opening folders and making them public for a lot of the articles that we read for these podcasts. So if you want to check out the articles yourself, just follow those folders and you'll get the articles as we're reading them. You'll see them as we see them. We also have a website up and running, questioningmedicine.com, which we're posting just not all the articles, because I understand people don't want to read other articles, but just a couple of them that you, if you have a moment, you should take a look at, and they're interesting. The more important ones are the ones that we found more interesting. We got some other things coming up in the future, but we'll let you know about those when they come about.
One small thing too, Andrew. Read by QXMD. It's coming out. It's in beta testing right now for Android products. So that should be out any time. I mean, they're in the last stages of troubleshooting, and it's totally worthwhile. It is a phenomenal engine for getting free or using your own login for your health institution or your school that you're affiliated with to getting articles and journal subscriptions. It's a phenomenal way to organize, highlight, categorize, and share. I totally recommend it to anybody that's listening to this.
Yeah, I agree. It is a great app, and if you haven't used it, it's free, so you might as well check it out, see if you like it. But we use it. We recommend it to everyone who just wants to get their hands on a bunch of articles on whatever topic you're interested in, whether it's what we're talking about today or some other topic. And if you have a topic, feel free to email us, questioningmedicine@gmail.com. I think until next time, just keep the quests and questioning.
Absolutely, and have a great time, guys. No more pelvics, huh?
yourself.